Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Bowlology Report. Again, a couple of fine guests, men who represent Australia in white ball cricket, did a great job, state legends, and now they've just eased into coaching at IPL level and BBL level. The first man is a Queenslander, 84 one days for Australia, 12 T20 games. James Hopes, thanks for joining us, big fella.
Thank you, Flem. Thanks for having me. It breaks up the day nicely.
I know you're busy in quarantine, so thanks for finding time. The next gentleman, Hopes, you played a lot with in one day cricket and against at state cricket. I'll let his brother's book do his introduction, okay? In fact, Dave was never out. If he nicked one to the keeper, he wouldn't walk. Even if he was clean bowled, he refused to hand over that bat. It was then when the fights began. That was spectacular. I would chase Dave around the backyard trying to give him a clip behind the ear because he was out and he wouldn't hand over the bat. Mum would be screaming. Dad would be shaking his head. It was all happening. Dave would chicken out and lock himself in the car and refuse to come out. That's how many of our games ended up. Him in tears, me in tears, and Dave certainly has some questions to answer about the dodgy tactics back then. David Hussey, welcome to the Bowlology Report.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Flynn, and bringing back poor memories. Appreciate it.
Yeah. So this is Mike Hussey, your brother's book. He's asked, he certainly has some questions. Have you ever answered these questions?
No, and nor have I ever read the book, but I might read. I'm currently in hotel quarantine and I'm struggling to sleep, so it might put me to sleep, I reckon.
It could, driven to succeed by Mr. Cricket, but certainly that's, you'd think he'd be a better bowler if he was bowling to you all the time as kids. Is that a fair
call? We had a lot of backyard battles, Flem. Unfortunately, Mike was far too good. My bowling was terrible, as it was when I progressed to the senior level. So, unfortunately, my batting wasn't much better back in the day either. So, rather than continue to bowl to him for hours, I end up just storming off, which is a bit soft, really.
Hopesy, what was your backyard cricket like?
So very similar to Dave's. I had a neighbour and my brother. We played the whole 92 World Cup in the backyard, going through every game, and it took a good 12 months, but we polished it off. We kept scorecards and everything. I don't know how old I was then. I was 10, 11, but we played the whole World Cup. Yeah.
Who won that? I know Pakistan won it at the G. Who won it at the Hoaxes?
I think it was the West Indies. I think we all liked Brian Lara. So whenever the West Indies played, like, he tended to score some runs. So that was nice.
And mate, who were you? If you're playing for Australia, who was your idol? Who were you in the backyard then?
Oh no, we were everyone, mate. We had to try and do whatever they did. So if we were Merv, we had to come in on the big angled run up. If we were Craig McDermott, we were allowed to bowl as fast as we want. If we were Wazzy Macram, we had to bowl from around the wicket and try swing it in. We had to try to do everything like they did on TV. But it went a little bit too far, but it was good fun.
That is awesome. Well, what about the Hussey brothers? Were you ever individual players?
Yep. I like Malcolm Marshall. He was one of my favourites. My brother loved Alan Border, so he was always Alan Border, and I was Malcolm Marshall, which allowed me to bowl over the line by a normal person bowling at practice in the nets during the week. But then this is how strange I am. I actually liked, remember in the 92 World Cup where Deepak Patel opened the bowling for New Zealand? Yeah. So I wanted to be him because he was quite a nice, correct batsman, but also he opened the bowling, so I wanted to be him. So a bit strange, but, yeah, I really liked Six-Pack Patel.
I reckon you're a bit more dynamic, or a lot more with the bat, but you actually did mimic his bowling at international level. I never thought about that.
I bowled utter junk, Damien, so I don't really like reliving my bowling.
Smoke and mirrors. That's all it was.
Your stats don't lie, D-Hus. They're actually pretty good. You used to sneak that little over in for the Stars too, didn't you?
Well, I had this plan, this theory that people aren't that smart. So if they're fatigued, I could always like sneak under their guard by bowling a quick over or two, and they're not thinking about what's coming down, and therefore they can't execute their plan. But certainly it worked a little bit, but not all the time. Generally fell on the wrong side of the equation there.
By that much.
It's almost like, as I said, with your careers, like a pretty similar amount of games for Australia and dominant first-class players. Was it always natural, firstly, to you, Hopesy, that you're going to progress into coaching?
I didn't think about it probably until Darren Lehman got the Australian job, and he called me from, I think he was on the Australia A tour in the UK when he got given the Australian job for the Ashes tour, and he called me and asked whether I was prepared to retire then and go into and take over the Queensland team. And I was only 33, 34. And I was like, no, mate, no, I'm not ready to stop playing just yet. So that's probably when I started to think about it. And then the progression became pretty natural, yeah.
What about you, D. Huss? Just settled in there at Kookaburra?
Yeah, always wanted to be a coach, probably about 34, 35. I really enjoyed probably wasn't quite good enough to play international cricket, so I wanted to try and fast-track some of these young kids who are probably more talented than me to realise their dreams of playing international cricket for Australia. So that was probably the motivation and, lucky to fall on my feet and work under some really good coaches and mentors, I guess.
Geez, you've led into that beautifully, Huss. So one of the reasons I got you on was your roles at the IPL. To talk about that, you're under some iconic head coaches, but also the conditions that the T20 World Cup's getting played in are obviously where the IPL was mimicked. But Hopesy, what about experiences there at Delhi? You're under R. Ponting. How have you found the environment that he creates?
He creates, I think I've said this a few times, I think he creates the best environment for a team that I've seen as a player or a coach now. And that's no disrespect to coaches I work under or coaches I played under. He's just exceptional at what he does. And you sort of wish he could be a bit more involved in the Australian team than what he is. But I understand he values time with his kids and that. So I think like his coaching at the moment is just going to revolve around the IPL, and he's exceptional at what he does, mate. It's a lot of fun working with him in Delhi. He can gel a change room very effectively. And I assume he's very similar to Baz in that regard.
Well, yeah, I'm lucky enough to work under McCullum, Kolkata. The first year was really getting to know Brendan and getting to know or build the relationships. And we just missed out in the finals. The second year, at the halfway mark, we were terrible. We were 2 wins from 7. And then the halfway mark hit and the postponement happened. And then we came back up and Brendan just freshened the place up. Spent a lot of one-on-one time with each different player, and he got a lot of hands-on work from the support staff with Kyle Mills, our bowling coach, myself, Abhishek Nair, Omki, the other bowling coach. So we're very, very lucky, and James Foster, our fielding coach. So very, very lucky in that point of view. But similar to Ricky, this creates a nice, easygoing, relaxed environment. Brendan has his vision and explains the vision beautifully and ask players to execute this vision, and the second half of the tournament was really enjoyable to watch and be a part of.
Sorry, mate, I think they're probably pretty similar, aren't they? They give players a lot of self-belief. I think that's one of their big strong points, is that they give players a lot of self-belief to do what they can do on the field to the best of their ability. I think they're very good motivators of individuals, and it shows in both teams' results, I think, in the last IPL.
Do you find it in T20 cricket under a good coaching structure, it's easier? I know as a player myself, I loved having my role defined and I could train for that specific role. Do the top T20 coaches and teams really focus on that?
from a batting point of view, if you're opening the batting, your role is pretty much generally defined anyway, because you're going out to bat, you target your bowler, you want to hit, you hit the areas of your strengths. Where it changes is the middle order players. Like, they might come in at 3 for 10 and might have to resurrect the innings, or they might come in at 1 for 150 off 10 and just go hell for leather. So you do adapt for that point of view, from that point of view. But as Hopesy rightly said before, the best thing about the two, Ricky and Brendan, they create the environment where you are bulletproof, you're the most important player in that dressing room, and you have absolute freedom to go out there and express the way you want to play. If you've done all the work going around, go for it, go smack it out of the stadium. If you try to hit 6 sixes in a row and you get out, that's okay. We're always trying to run towards the contest rather than run away from it.
Hopesy, what about from a bowling perspective? We used to joke, Victoria and Australia really, that 90% of our bowling plan to each batter was, yeah, he's a bit of a nicker early on, off stump, just outside, and if he gets settled, the odd bouncer. Please tell me it's just gone a little bit more versatile than that.
I'm going to be honest, mate. Top of off is still the hardest ball to hit. The thing you find interesting about the IPL, or what I found interesting about the IPL, is we got Nokia and Rabada in our team, and we use them the complete opposite to the way South Africa is using them at the moment in the World Cup. And we used them to great effect. And that's one of the challenges of the IPL as well. You get these guys coming in who are world-class performers, and you're asking them to do things sometimes that they don't do, and that's a challenge for them. And that's where it comes down to your head coaches and your support staff to create an environment that they believe they can do that in. But I found it quite funny that what we did the whole way through the IPL pretty much was you use those two in a certain role, and then I'm watching South Africa play in this World Cup and they're being used in complete opposite roles. So that's been quite funny.
So can you just clarify that?
So we give Norkie the first over because he bowls 150 kilometres there and swings them. And we use Rabada in the middle overs a little bit more. But watching South Africa play, they're giving Rabada the new ball and using Nokia at the back end of the power play and in the middle overs. And they're both working. It just shows probably their skill sets and like how good they are. And I think South Africa with those two bowlers might be a sneaky show in this World Cup.
What about the conditions in the? We'll go into the T20 World Cup, but you know the conditions they're playing in the areas where the IPL was played. So how do you think it's going to play out with spin starting to dominate, or in some venues, the quicks are still going to play a big part?
I still believe the quicks are going to play a huge part in the World Cup. You play at three venues: Abu Dhabi, Sharjah, and Dubai. I do believe the Jew might play a bit of a role in the back half of the tournament. So. Yeah, it's going to be quite difficult for the spinners to grip the ball, but also for the quickies to execute their stock ball and Yorkers, I guess. The pitches in the IPL, at Abu Dhabi, they were pretty good. They were a little bit slow, a little bit low, but they generally were quite batsman-friendly. You generally get about 160, 170 par score, and you generally hold on to defend that. Sharjah was the interesting one. Kolkata played Delhi there twice, once in a qualifying game and once in a semi, in a prelim final, and I think the scores are 130 and 135 or something. Correct me if I'm wrong, Hopesy. And it turned, but we were fortunate in the prelim final. There was lots of dew around, which made the pitch probably a little bit easier to bat on in the second part of that game there. But it's always a difficult place to play, Sharjah. You never know really what kind of pitch you're going to get. The dew does play a big part, but also there's small boundaries. So you can have three very, very good overs and then get hit for 25 off the next over and you're sort of back in the contest. Whereas Dubai is just a great cricket stadium. It's generally a pretty good cricket pitch. Dew does play a part, but it's generally just an outstanding stadium. And whoever makes the final is going to have to utilise the conditions to the best of their ability.
So for Australia's chances, Hopesy, if they can keep this momentum, that's not a bad place to play the final.
Yeah, it's a great place for them. I think where Australia might. The little chink in Australia in Australia's armour is our fifth bowler option at the moment. I think last night our fifth bowler went for 51 when they got 150. So I think, as like Huss said, when we get onto the better pitches in Dubai, and I don't think we play another game in Abu Dhabi, but when we get into Dubai, our fifth bowler, they whether we should change our team up slightly to get a fifth specialist bowler in there is something that they'll have to think about.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Like, yeah, Agar, Swepson are the two spinners. Stoinis has batted really well, getting us home. Maxi bowled beautifully in the first game, didn't he? Opening up, you know, that could work against the West Indies, but he got taken down in his one over overnight.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Do you play the extra bowler and then you rob Peter with the batting to pay Paul with the bowling, or do you rob Paul to pay Peter with the bat and the ball? So I really like having Steve Smith in the middle order. He's a great player of spin and he can control the tempo, sort of bats with the opening batter who's flying, or can control Stoinis at the back end with Wade as well. So it's going to be rather difficult to get the extra spin bowler in. But if you do, I don't think you're going to go wrong with Agar or Shrepson. Shrepson's done really well in the BBL, especially against the Stars, mind you. So, but yeah, they're both good fielders and they both compete. I tend to agree with Hopesy that you probably will have to get a spin in there at some stage, but I'm not sure for who. It's going to be quite a difficult selection.
Yeah, it's always what you spend a lot of time talking about, isn't it? That when you pick T20 teams, you normally have nine guys you pick, and then you spend all your time talking about guys that bat 6, 7, 8.
Yeah.
It's the most frustrating part of T20 teams, yeah.
Yeah, in any form of T20 cricket, you know, and I think that's the chance for cricketers to find a real niche for himself in that 5 to 7, be able to bang them. Because I think we got in trouble in the past too a little bit, picking the top scorers in the Big Bash, and then they have to bat in the middle order, a bit like what you were saying with South African bowlers. Like, so it's a big adjustment. You've made your name opening all three. Hey, just to clarify a analogy you used there, Huss, the robbing Peter. So is Peter the batter and Paul the bowler?
I don't think it really matters, Flem.
I reckon you mix. Yeah, I just need you to. I'll clarify that a bit later. So who's winning the T20 World Cup? What's the final?
You go, Hopesy.
I'm going to say, I'll give you the final four. Pakistan, yes. Pakistan, Australia, India, England. Is that possible?
Yes.
Yes.
I tend to agree, and I think the final will be either Australia and Pakistan or England and Pakistan.
Yeah. See, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, like perception with India coming out of their own IPL, you just think they're the best prepared team, but there's also that pressure.
Yep,
at big tournaments, and it just goes so quickly. And certainly England, even with no Archer or Stokes, geez, they've got power and bowlers that can defend, as long as they score big enough to defend that. But let's hope the Aussies go all the way here. Come on, Aussie, come on. What about the Big Bash, boys? I want to rewind, because you guys are there the initial, and do you feel like it's a bit of a myth, you know, how big it become once we went to city based? Because in those last couple of years, you were playing state based. I remember crowds. There was a game at the MCG against Tassie, Victoria, that was nearly 50,000. The Gabba was always consistently around that 20,000 mark. Can you recall when you realised that moment that this is starting to build and become something big?
I love playing state v state BBL, T20 cricket. It was awesome. Wherever you went around, generally there were good crowds. The cricket played was phenomenal. You had three very good fast bowlers, you had two very good spinners, and the batting was just second to none. So wherever you went around Australia, it was tough cricket played, whether you're playing in Belrive, Adelaide, Gabba, Wacker, wherever. It was always really good play. Two of the games that I remember distinctly are the Tassie game that you're talking about, where Brad Hodge just played out of his skin. I think we were chasing about 170. I was thinking it's a difficult pitch. They got Rana Naveed bowling. This is going to be quite a tough chase. And then I think Hodge got about 80 off about 35 balls, and we got him in the 16th over. It was just incredible. The atmosphere emanating from that, or the loudness or the volume coming out of that crowd was just phenomenal, and it's just something I'll never forget. But then New South Wales v Victoria at the MCG, where Dave Warner got, I think, about 90 off about 60 balls and ended up getting about 180 at the MCG. And we ended up chasing him down with Dwayne Bravo hitting, I think it was about 40 off about 15 balls. The noise emanating out of that stadium that night when we won in the last over, I think two balls to spare, was just incredible. And you actually look back on some of those highlights and you see some of the players sitting on the sideline, like Finch was next in the bat, who's now probably one of the best T20 players Australia's ever produced. So yeah, it was really enjoyable to play in those T20 state v state fixtures.
Hey, see, what were your memories before it became city-based?
I just go back to, we played New South Wales at the Gabba. I'm not sure when it was. It was Graham Dixon was CEO, and I was opening the batting with Craig Phillipson against Nathan Bracken. And, you know, you guys will remember state games at the Gabba, they only used to open half the ground.
Yeah.
And we got told when we were waiting to go out to bat that there's just been a little bit of a delay, and we're like, okay. And that was a gimmicky thing that night. Someone from the crowd bowled the first ball. So they gave him a ball.
If you're listening, make sure you message it. We'll get you on. But, yeah, keep going.
And Craig Phillipson said, I don't know what to do, because he was going to face. And I think Brad Haddon was keeping it. He said, you've got to try hitting for six. And he just launched this thing like 20 rows back over the side screen. And it was this guy. The guy was so happy, the guy that bowled the first ball. He was pumped. But then when we looked up in the stands, people were streaming around all the parts of the stands that weren't open. So what had happened is that all these people had just been game day walk-ups to come watch the game, and Graham Dixon just ended up throwing the gates open to the Gabba. Fantastic. And the place just filled up in about 20 minutes. 2005.
He's passed now, Graham, isn't he? But I remember him saying he was physically got the keys and was unlocking gates.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it was that.
So that was when I thought, this T20 gimmick, as we used to call it back then, is going to be quite big. And I think just going to City Base was just the natural progression after what happened the first year of the IPL, which was Dave was there. It was bigger than anything I've seen.
Back to that Tasmanian game, it was 45,000-46,000. The thing I noticed commentating, walking around, was the crowd, though. Like the bars were filled. There was families there and the bars were filled, but it was the quota was 50-50, you know, males and females. And it was, I think it was a Friday. It was almost like the young crowd had come in to have a drink in the Smith Bar, and then they were going to go out. What about all the way to now, boys? You're in coaching roles. How have you found it adjusting player into the intensity of, in particular, T20 cricket, and how much control can you actually control, and how much are you going to let go to the players on the field?
Well, firstly, it's changed from that gimmicky T20 cricket when we played. Like, remember Andrew Johns playing for New South Wales? We tried.
He hasn't retired either. So if you guys have got a spot.
We tried to get Jonathan Brown to play for the Stars. For Victoria 1 year. It didn't pan out. The first year for the Melbourne Stars, I think Andy Lee was hunting around for a game as well. So, still a little bit gimmicky. But then transferring from a player to in the coaching staff, you don't realise how much work goes into preparing all players individually and as a group as well. Like, speaking from a batting point of view, you have these strike rate and wagon wheels, and who you're better against, who you're worse against, what do you need to improve on, where you think the opposition bowler is going to bowl to you. And we're going to sort of try and make this information or solidify all this information and make it really succinct so the player can understand in their own language, and then therefore they're going out to bat with not too much in their mind. They're just free and easy, and then go out there and just have fun. And you don't realise until they go out to play that you can't control whatever they do. You just can't control. So you just sort of hopefully it turns out well on the day.
Very true. Hopefully, how do you find it?
Exactly. So I agree with Huss. Like when they walk out there, you realise you got no control. But there's been many times where you wish you were just hooked up to the bowler to say like what are you thinking? Like, yeah. I'm not sure why you've done that. Like, and but yeah, like Huss is right. Like, you go through so many pages of stuff to try to break it down to four lines that you think might make a difference for the individual player, and that's just for the team taking the field. Then we got the seven reserve players that'll travel with the squad, and then you're trying to make sure they're ready to go at short notice and keep them engaged. And we don't have the staffs in the BBL that we have in the IPL, and we got like 10 coaches, so we don't have that many people. So it becomes very hectic, and then you do all the work, and then they walk out on the field, and you start thinking, did you tell them that? Did you tell them that? Did you tell them that? But you've just got to trust them. You just got to trust them. That these guys are, there's some very experienced guys running around now, and I know from the Brisbane Heat perspective, someone like Jimmy Pearson used to be constantly talking to him about it. Now you can just let him go about his preparation. He does a lot of it by himself. He's he's all over it by himself now the last 12 months or so. So you can see the guys growing and becoming more dependent on what they're doing.
We just played each other, Delhi v Kolkata, in the prelim final of the IPL. And the game was done and dusted. We only needed 7 runs to win off 2 overs. Game's over and done with. And all of a sudden, we kept losing wicket, wicket, wicket. And Shakib Al-Hassan's gone out to bat. And he tried to play a sweep. And the analyst turned around to me and goes, tell him to play straight. It's like, what do you want me to do? Like, he's out batting. I'm the batting coach in the dugout. Run out and tell a message. It's like, yeah, okay. It's just like that, is it?
Gloves,
yeah. Next step will be like the NFL. They'll have helmets with microphones in their earpieces and be saying, play straight, play up the pitch, you know, and it's just, it's comical.
Well, you're probably too young to remember it, but Bobby Woolmer and Hansi Cronje did that in the 1999 World Cup. Which got banned. You just can't get to that, can you? Like, I like what you said, Hopesy. And that must be the art of coaching as well, being able to let go and to realise when a player, when Jimmy Pearson, who's taken into Shield cricket now too, isn't he, but needs less of that, but then there's always going to be players that are going to need a bit more hands-on coaching.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly. Just going back to something Huster said, I don't know whether you watched our game versus Chennai, which was the qualifying final. Is that what it's called? The qualifying final? Or the,
yeah.
I don't know. And we get down to the last over and Chennai need 13 to win. We got Tom Curran's bowled 3 overs, 2 for 16. And Rabada's bowled 3 overs. And Dhoni's on strike. And I turned around a punter and said, I think he's going to bowl Tom Curran, which is the most, like, no disrespect to Tom Curran, but it's a stupid decision.
Yeah.
And I said to Rick, we got to stop the game. So we can't stop the game. and then Tom Curran bowled it, not Rabada, and we lost it in 4 balls, and it's like, oh God. Oh God. And you know what the owners say, don't you, Huss? Why didn't you stop the game?
Yeah. And so that's interesting still. That is purely the captain's decision. We are with the other leaders on the field. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think because he was out there in the emotion of it. He just went with the hot hand, which was Tom Curran. But everything pointed towards you've just bowled Rabada to Dhoni. But he just, yeah. it was just an impulse decision, which you can see how a captain makes that on the field in that situation. But when you're removed and you don't have the emotional aspect sitting on the sideline, you know it's the wrong decision. And that's a real hard part of coaching. I think Huss will agree with that.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
I want to talk about you guys as opponents. Victoria versus Queensland. Hopesy, I think you won. Did you win 4 Sheffield Shields?
I'm this is going to sound bad. I don't. Three. I don't know. I played in a lot of finals.
It seemed like you were in it every year, Queensland. And Victoria for a while was the same. How many did you win, Huss?
I was part of 4 winning Shields, Flynn. So very, very lucky.
I said he was very lucky that one at Junction Oval. Bucky got 100. Bucky was dead LBW, second ball of the day. And Pistol must have been sleeping. I don't know what was going on. I'm still angry about that. It was only 13 years ago.
Is that a joke? Of course Pistol was sleeping. That's what he did.
I don't know what he was looking at.
Can we go back even further, though, Hopesy? This is all about Huss. The Shield final in 03-04. Victoria, 710.
Yeah, and I'm going to be honest.
Queensland, 275. That's right. So do you remember the chat about that?
I will tell a story. I was sitting in the change room. It was Optus that used to televise the games?
Yeah. Was it your first Shield final?
That was my first Shield final. I've never seen a flatter wicket the day before a game. Like, it looks so flat. And we won the toss, and you see Jimmy, the sound was down, you see Jimmy Ma talking to whoever was doing the toss, and we were like, yes, we're batting first. And then word came down that we were bowling first, and I was sitting across the room, Andy Bickle, and his shoes came flying across the change room. That's all I remember. And then I do remember still bowling 3 days later.
And all I remember, Flynn, from that is we saw the commentator go to Jimmy Ma first, our collective souls just drop to the floor thinking, oh, we're in the field here, right? How do we get all these wickets out, blah, blah. Then all of a sudden you see Chuck, Darren Berry, doing this to us with you little Anzac. We're cheering. And then we proceeded to watch Matthew Elliott and Jason Arnberger put on, I think they put on about 220-230 for the first wicket.
It was a lot. I think you were one down at the end of the first half. You one down?
Oh. Matthew Elliott. And you have to bowl them out, don't you, Hopesy? So do you remember what it was like as it just kept going and going?
It was a bit deflating, mate, to be honest. Like, one of the greatest, like Jimmy Marr gave us the greatest, I think it was late day four. We needed 500 and I don't know what you guys set us because you needed 550 to win, I reckon. And he gave us this motivational speech, and I love Jimmy. It was an impassioned plea to go out there and this, you just never know. And he proceeded to go out there and nick the first one, and we were one for none. Like, good start, boys. But that was a good introduction to Shield Finals. I think they were building. Was there only half a stadium then too?
Yeah, only half a stadium. All I remember from that, Flem, is and Hopesy, is that we batted first, and I was watching Elliott, Arnberger, Hodge, Moss put on all these massive runs, and my parents flew over from Perth to see me play. And I was that tired, just waiting to go to bat. Finally get an opportunity to go to bat, nick off, I think it was under 10 or whatever, and then watch everybody below me get 50, 60, 70. And I was just selfishly praying that one of the tail enders just got lower than me, so I wasn't the lowest score in the team. So then I think Mick Lewis was just maybe a run short than me then in the scoreboard. But, geez, I was so thankful that he got nicked off just under my first inning score. But what a game. It was 5 days of first day was like rather nerve-wracking, but yeah. Day two, three, four, and five was just a pleasure to be a part of. It was so relaxed, so easy, and we just knew we were going to win because we had Elliott and Hodge batting and Mick Lewis with the ball.
Huss, you got 16, Mickey Lewis 11, so you would have been nervous. And it's probably a bit like an AFL grand final when your team knows you're winning at half time, isn't it? So, Hopesy, what about 2 years later? You've got the home final, 05-06. You're playing the Vics. What's the talk going into that? Is it payback time, or is it just purely let's win the game?
The talk going into it was actually a little bit more about the year before. We'd been beaten by New South Wales at home in the Shield final.
That was an unbelievable final, wasn't it?
That was an unbelievable final. That was an unbelievable final. But the Victorian game, we lost the toss there too. That was a beautiful wicket as well.
Yep.
But the talk going into it was that we just get ourselves in a position, battle bowl first, that we bat once. So we were, it was on our mind to go big if we batted, yeah. So we lost the toss and we're bowling. And I know Victoria might have been 2 for 200.
Yep, correct.
2 for 238. Going well.
And Huss, I reckon, did you get not out in the first innings?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
You did? And you batted late on that first day, but for some reason we kept playing and it was dark.
Yeah.
And everyone just got out?
Well, Hodge got 100 and started celebrating by doing push-ups, and he pretty much did a whole lap of the Gabba. and we're all like thinking, come on, calm down. Then it started raining. It was like, oh, the lights came on and Andy Bickle and I think you got a few wickets to folks here at the time. We nicked off everything and somehow I survived. I'm not sure how. And then the next day, the early morning Gabba started a little bit early. We sort of got nicked off. But I'll rewind to the night before we had a team meeting and we're all excited and all nervous. And Greg Shippard gave us a big motivational prep up, how to win away from home, Queensland. They don't like playing from behind, blah, blah. And I said, can I interrupt you there, Greg? Mate, they don't like playing from behind. We need to win the toss and bat. We get 350. We'll be playing from in front. We'll bowl Queensland out for 250. We'll get 400 in the third innings, and then we'll bowl them out again late on day five. We'll win. We'll be celebrating, holding up the Pura Cup. That was the name back then. I was right with the 350 on the first innings, but when they scored 900 in the first innings, I was thinking, oh, dear. This might have been the wrong decision at that first. But, yeah, it was a long, long game.
They passed you one down.
And do you know how we got the wicket?
No.
We got run outs.
Oh, you ran Lockie Stevens out.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, John Mostert and Aiden Fielding. Yeah.
So I'll run through the scores, boys. Jimmy got through them. 223. Martin Love, what a beautiful player. 169. Watto, 201. And the underrated Clint Perrin, 173. So you had plenty of time to rest up to bowl in the second innings there, Hoaxy.
Hey, Flem, can you keep going down that scorecard and tell me who batted six?
It's Andy Bickle ahead of you. Yeah. What was that?
Okay. So I was sitting down. So when I bat six, and when we're two out, I normally get my gear up to the viewing room at the Gabba. And so we were two out. I don't know what stage we were two out. But I sat there, I reckon, watching Perrin and Watson bat, pat it up, and then I think that was the year. I reckon I did it for a day, 120 overs or something. I was watching him bat, just sitting there, pat it up, watching. And then I reckon Terry Oliver was coach. He came in and said, mate, I think we're going to send Bick before you. And pardon my French, but like I'd been sitting here for 120 overs waiting to bat, and you come in now and say you're going to send Bick in front of me. And the reasoning was I think he'd had 50 wickets that year.
Yep.
And he needed 30 runs or something to get 500 runs. So he would have been the first person ever to get 50 wickets and 500 runs in a Shield season. So I took my pads off. Bick went out and got out. And then I went in at seven, and the first ball I'm facing is from Nick Jewell, and I'm going, oh, this is bad. And then they took the fourth Newey, and Dirk Natters bounced me out. I think that's what happened.
Yeah. So just on that, we had a big focus of stopping Andy Bickle because it was all throughout the paper getting 50 wickets and making 500 runs. So our big focus was stopping Andy Bickle doing this. Unfortunately, it took today, halfway through day three or day four, to actually get to Andy before he batted. And then Dirk Natters, who used to bowl swift, he wasn't bowling as quick to the top order. But then as soon as Andy Bickle came out to bat, geez, he let them fly and got him out straight away. And then I think he got Hoaxy out too about three or four balls later. It was like, God, where was this day two, you know?
Oh, it was hard to stay mentally up. But you get in, you look at the scoreboard. You're 5 for 890, and you're like, oh, what's happening?
Yeah, you walked out at basically 5 for 184. Who would have ever thought that? Just on the second, I remember hearing, though, second innings, Vicks get 200, Johnson 6 for 50. Hearing searing pace and not surprisingly, career. Boom, after that. Do you recall Mitchell Johnson's bowling in that last innings?
It was fast,
wasn't it, Hoaxy? Yeah, very fast. Yeah. All I remember is that second innings, Shipit gave us a big spill about being pride to play for the draw. There's no, please play with courage, you know, play for pride. Draw means everything. Don't let them win, blah, blah, blah. Jason Unberger, I think he got 10, 15, maybe 20 in the second innings, and Johnson came out and bowled the speed of light. And I was batting five at that stage. He gets nicked off, and with his pads on, he goes straight to the fridge, grabs a drink, and he goes, good luck out there, mate. Mitchell Johnson's bowling the speed of light. I was like, oh, gosh. So I walk out the bat late on day four that day thinking, oh, no, I don't really want to face this guy. But, yeah, he just bowled thunderbolts. Oh, absolute rockets. And he got six with about 30, I think, in the end. And they bowled us out just before tea time day five.
Hoaxy, was there? Did you think that was the turning point for Mitchell?
Yeah. He's always been there or thereabouts, hasn't he? I remember he made his debut against New Zealand, I reckon, in a tour match at the Gabba when he was a kid. And he was fast then too. And I think just a story about him, which I think is a great story, that was definitely the turning point in terms of him playing for Australia and going to do what he did. But when he was out with stress fractures and he got delisted by Queensland for some reason, he went back and played third grade for Norse and opened the batting. And scored a mountain of runs in third grade for a season. So I think that says a little bit about him, and it also says a little bit about about why his batting was ended up being pretty good, because he took a lot of time when he was out injured to work on his batting and make that effective. And, to be honest,
I think he was delivering pizzas as well, Hopesy.
He was, and he was working for a plumbing supply company as well. I've got some good stories about Mitch. He backed into my car once in the car park and at Queensland Cricket. I've got some good stories about Mitch. But for another
Give us one. Besides that
was a good one. He backed into my car and drove off. And I've gone out to the car park and gone, what's happened to my car? Like, who drove into it? And they said, oh, Mitch did it. I was like, well, where is he? And they said, oh, he's left.
So when you confront him, what did he say? Because you don't want to play for the Nets. You want to do it in a pretty good way.
Oh, I just called him and said, Mitch, did you hit my car? Oh, I didn't want to tell you. Well, I'm going to find out, mate. Oh, he's a great man, Mitch Johnson. He's a good guy.
That's just a little bit of an obscure one. Do you know who you got out to in the second innings?
Dan Duran. I got bowled. The ball didn't bounce. Rolled. Absolutely rolled. But by that stage, my legs were bleeding. I was so tired from fielding 240-odd overs in the first innings. I remember when I was batting at the time, Clinton Perrin was fielding on the offside and he kept saying, this is payback from 203-04. The team who laughs the loudest. And I couldn't stop chuckling as Duran's running into bowl. Clinton Perrin had this knack of making everybody laugh and, geez, I couldn't stop laughing. Unfortunately, I'm not really sure, this ball just rolled and hit the stumps because the other end, Mitch, he was bowling the speed of light and I probably didn't really fancy facing him either. So one of those things. But, yeah, Queensland had the last laugh and they laughed very loudly that night.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining the Bowlology Report. Good luck over the summer. It's been tough. COVID, you know, has made squads really hard, but good luck to the Brisbane Heat and the Melbourne Stars, boys.
Thank you.
And if I can finish just on another quote from the Bible, Mr. Cricket, driven to succeed, he says, the difference between the ordinary and the extraordinary is that little bit extra. And I'll counter that with another quote of a former Australian player called Wayne Phillips, Flipper. And his motivational quote was, no pain, no pain.
I like
thanks,
that
boys. Enough.
Thanks, Flem. Thanks, Hopesy. Thank it's been a pleasure.
See you, mate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.